This podcast is presented by Convergence, a magazine for radical insights.
If you really think about it, you know, I say, I know that a lot of movement will position, I guess, capitalism as like, if we just got rid of capitalism, then all the rest of this goes. But when you really think about it, misogyny and sexism and, you know, gender-based discrimination and bias actually is much more of an original sin. It's older, you know? And so I think that when you're dealing with a problem that predates modern capitalism, you have to have a sharper lens on it.
Welcome to the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast, a project of the 22nd Century Initiative. I'm Scott Nakagawa, one of your hosts.
Hello, friends. I'm co-host Sue Hyde. Scott and I first joined forces about 30 years ago to help defeat anti-LGBTQ ballot measures proposed by Christian authoritarian groups.
It was as true then as it is now that those of us who believe in democracy make up a supermajority of people in this country. The challenge is, how do we go from being the majority to acting like the majority?
We dig into strategy questions like these and prescriptions for change. We talk with expert guests and commentators whose scholarship, political activism, and organizing define the cutting edge of anti-authoritarian resistance. Thank you for joining us.
Rachel O'Leary Carmona is the executive director of Women's March and Women's March Network. Together, Women's March and the Women's March Network form the backbone of the largest political home for women on the left. Before that, Rachel served as the chief operating officer of the Women's March starting in 2018. She oversaw the building of the infrastructure of the Women's March as an organization from a series of record-breaking mobilizations I think most of us have heard of. She oversaw the incorporation of Women's March Network, the sister organization of Women's March, and founded Women's March WIN, a super PAC that builds and mobilizes the political power of women. Under Rachel's leadership, Women's March drove record turnout in 2018, playing a key role in defeating Trump in 2020, anchored 4,500 nationwide actions in the United States, mobilizing tens of millions in 2022. And mobilized women in a pivotal 2023 Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, a race that was called the most important of the year by the New York Times. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm super excited for the discussion.
Welcome, Rachel. I'm happy to say I've never missed a Women's March.
Me neither, actually. Even before I worked at Women's March, I marched in D.C. the first time.
Let's dig into some questions. So if the goal is to create a multiracial democracy where everyone is heard and rights are protected, right, we all want that, how do you and Women's March frame women's rights as a democracy issue?
Mm-hmm. I think there's probably 20 ways to answer that question. And one of the things that's up for me right now is that it's not just, you know, we have an election in 2024 where what's on the ballot is freedom versus fascism. Pretty much wherever you go, you know, whether you're talking about a state level, a city race, or, you know, certainly the national race. But what I've been thinking about lately is that about half of the countries in the world are actually going to elect leaders this year. We saw the European election just happened, and we are seeing broadly a rise in authoritarianism. And so when we're talking about women's rights and we're talking about feminism as a politic, I think it's really important for us to understand the context and the conditions that we're in. And one of the things that is true in all of the countries that are inside of these election moments is that the people who are trying to take away rights, curtail rights, limit freedoms, and move us towards authoritarianism are attacking democracy on the battleground of women's rights and women's bodies, women's autonomy, women's ability to exercise agency inside of economic spheres, meaning, you know, like, can we go and work? Do we get a fair wage? Do we have childcare, healthcare? But certainly also make it harder for women to vote, and particularly women who, you know, have, you know, who carry multiple identities that are under attack from these folks, like women of color or trans women or queer women or what have you. And so necessarily, I think we have to understand the attacks on women's rights and the rollback on women's rights as an attack on democracy. And so the flip side of that coin necessarily is that we need a mass movement led by women who hold a feminist politic, because it's not enough, you know, and those two, you know, terms are not interchangeable. Not all women are feminists, and not all feminists are women. And so we need to kind of understand the two sides of the same coin as we're heading into this pivotal election year, and, you know, where democracy will be decided, not just here, but in many other, you know, many other countries.
Rachel, you mentioned that not all women are feminists and not all feminists are women. So I just want to share with you that when I was 19, the day I came out to my mother, she asked me, are all feminists lesbians? And to that topic, Rachel, how do you analyze the authoritarian's obsession with LGBTQ people and communities? And I am purposely not using the word issues, because the obsession is really quite targeted to people, humans, and our communities. What is going on here?
I'm trying to have an answer that's not quite as shady as my first response, which is just like, I feel like their obsession is equally proportionate with the amount of right-wing extremists who at some point get outed for having some sort of gay, you know, relationships or, you know, sexual or romantic or otherwise. And I think that, I mean, for me, I think that the rise of authoritarianism, and in our country, you know, Christian nationalism cannot be overlooked. And I think that, you know, inside of the queer community, and particularly the LGBT advocacy, it's sort of an interesting spot, because, you know, I was working at a gay rights organization when, you know, Prop 8 was in California, which was the, you know, the California proposition to legalize marriage equality. And, you know, when that didn't happen, you know, we were all sitting around our computer in you know, what would be a kind of a gross kind of preview of the way I felt later on when Trump was elected, but we were all just watching the results and like, oh no, we're gonna lose, you know? And then I remember sitting at my computer just a few years later. I was moving back to New York from grad school. So I remember it so clearly, of, you know, the Supreme Court case. And I think that what ended up happening was a very clear alignment inside of LGBT advocacy, inside of a big tent that, you know, we were able to build that push that win. And I remember reading later about, you know, how what the Supreme Court said, you know, is what we have to consider is, has there been a sea change of public opinion as it relates to marriage when deciding the issue of marriage equality? And so I think that the authoritarian's obsession with LGBT people and communities is related to this sea change. You know, I think that I don't think that we can take this for granted, but I do think that our side has the culture. You know, we have public opinion and we have the culture. And I think that queer folks inside of movement, I mean, a lot of movements, including women's marches, is led by queer people, whether or not their main intervention is LGBT advocacy specifically. But I do think that, you know, the movement is queer led, it's feminist led. And I think that it becomes a very easy tool to use as a cudgel based on our country's historical Puritanical roots, and certainly then the evangelical money and influence that folks have. So, I mean, I think it's not just one thing. I think it's many things. I think it's that, some of the latest and most definitive wins that we've had as a movement have come from the LGBT movement. And so I think that there's a very clear desire to undermine the most clear and present threats to a political agenda. And then I also think that, you know, the right wing's politics have made some strange bedfellows, because you've got, you know, people like Trump, we've got career Republican, politicians who have been married and divorced 5 times, sex scandals. Some of them have scandals with underage, people who then are with these evangelical folks trying to build power. And so for me, I think it's hard to unpack, and I don't call myself, an expert in LGBT, advocacy. I work at Women's March. I don't work at a queer organization anymore. But what I will say is that I noticed very clearly, we never have more bots and more, kind of hate than when we post anything related to trans issues, because the antis and our opposition very, very much do not want us to find common cause, common purpose, and to build power with queer folks. And I think that it's something that we need to pay attention to, that when we can find ways to bridge across the silos of, community-based organizing and start to build a big tent and a big we, they're very clear, and I think that we should become as clear that we have the ability to defeat them if we can do that at scale. So I think that's my first blush to the question, but I'm also happy to dig into any of those pieces, because there's a lot there.
Well, they're clearly intimidated by us, and so they must discredit us one by one by one. And also in the broad brush of not just LGBTQ communities, but the power that LGBTQ advocacy has had in some very deep cultural transformations.
100%.
So they're scared as shit.
I mean, if you think about the activism that happened around, the ACT UP era, if you think about marriage equality, and I think that they would love to continue to, I think the LGBT movement needed a reorientation, after the marriage equality decision, and to try to, a lot of the movement and a lot of the big organizations in the movement were so, had been dragged into that fight, however unwillingly, but then had to kind of reorient to, the conditions at hand. What is the clear and present danger? And so I think that there is a lot of lessons to be learned. I think about the message discipline. I think about the organizing that was done around marriage equality all the time when I'm thinking about, Women's March work. And I think that if we weren't always so busy dealing with all of these myriad crises and bullshit that we have to go through all the time, and we could sit and learn from the wins that are happening. So whether we're talking about the LGBT movement or whether we're talking about the green wave in Mexico and Argentina, if we could actually pull out and say, what are the necessary preconditions for winning? What are the things that happened that won? What are the things that are the same or different? How do we pivot? And if we had more time to learn, I think we could have a much more unbroken string of wins as well.
Well, Rachel, I used to be in ACT UP in the late 80s, so thank you for remembering us. But I think your warning is really, important. Hitler built an entire army on the basis of masculinism, male insecurities, and sexual anxiety. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty well documented historically, and I think we see something like it happening here. So I'm not trying to, propose that anyone is the equivalent of Hitler, but that same kind of tactical playbook seems to be being used here. And so really critical, important that we understand that.
And I think you could look at the parallels with the manosphere, the rise of the alpha male podcasters. And I think you could see early, I know there are a number of nerds on this podcast. I won't out anybody, but, you know, with Gamergate or any of the things where not just women and not just queer people, but specifically women and queer people of color are consistently dragged inside of these like traditionally male places. And then that's just escalated to move beyond places like Reddit or, you know, like the MAGA movement was, you know, really born inside of recruiting in video games, like masculine first-person shooter video games. And so I think that you're very right about that, like the threats to masculinization, you know, to, you know, the almost like gay panic, you know what I mean, that we've seen over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the author Kathleen Belew, she's a historian, wrote a book called Bring the War Home, which I highly recommend to our podcast listeners. But in Bring the War Home, she talks about the origins of the current white nationalist movement, or at least the paramilitary part of it. And it's very clear that one of the pillars of, you know, kind of ideological drivers, I guess, of the white nationalist movement at that level is the idea that the United States was emasculated specifically in the war in Vietnam, that that defeat represented a betrayal to the men who served and was an emasculation of the United States on the global stage. So these themes of gender and masculinity come up over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I think much too overlooked relative to, you know, some of the other kinds of attacks that they're launching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree. If you really think about it, you know, I say, I know that a lot of movement will position, I guess, capitalism as like, if we just got rid of capitalism, then all the rest of this goes. But when you really think about it, misogyny and sexism and, you know, gender-based discrimination and bias actually is much more of an original sin. It's older, you know? And so I think that when you're dealing with a problem that predates modern capitalism, you have to have a sharper lens on it. And I think that, you know, of course, we can critique our opposition and say they're doing all of these, you know, they're doing all the things that we've talked about. But I think we also need to be self-reflective as well in this moment. And, you know, I oftentimes say that sexism is one of the very few bipartisan agreement points that our side struggles with it just as much. And I think that we have to come to terms, you know, with that and understand that while we've sharpened our lenses on many things, we have not gotten to the point where we can, you know, where we are where we need to be as it pertains to like gender justice. And, you know, there will be some spaces where, like, I've been told directly by, you know, leaders of organizations that say, oh, well, the idea that you want to run an organization called Women's March is actually transphobic. And, you know, being in community with a lot of trans women, they're like, that's a wild analysis. And so I think that we have to be very clear in saying, like, what are we trying to do? Like, I think that's really the question. And I think so many of our movement disagreements or things like that are actually embroiled in this sense of we might not be trying to do the same thing. We at Women's March, you know, we're trying to win. And so what that means is we do not believe that we have the luxury of not organizing people who may not be all the way politically aligned with us for whatever reason, maybe because they're new to, you know, a political analysis, maybe because they actually are very political but disagree, you know, whatever. But we think that we have a mandate to organize those people to come along with us, but that we cannot afford to just let them go. And I say that specifically around gender justice, because the first year that Trump got elected, there was, you know, everyone was saying white women elected Trump, 53% of white women elected Trump. And then when the numbers shook out, come to find out that that number was off. It was 47% of women, white women, which is still way too many. Like, I don't want to, you know, excuse is not right the word. I'm not trying to like make excuses for that, but, it is certainly much, that 5% variance is much, it does not account for the margin by which he won. You know, like white women did not, you know, vote for Trump, but so as a block. However, in 2020, 53% of white women did vote for Trump. And I think we have to question, you know, in the rhetoric that we on the left moved forward and the way that we organized, the way that we resourced organizing, et cetera, did we contest for that, you know, for those votes? Because in the end, we lost ground. So I think we have to be very serious about what we're trying to do. We're not trying to be right at Women's March. We're not trying to be like day ones. We know better than you. You know, we have the right vocabulary, you know, whatever. We are trying to get as many people inside of the struggle as possible and win for all of us. And we are very clear that it's possible. And we do that by being in a relationship with trans folks. We do that by being in a relationship with, you know, racial justice folks, trans folks, queer advocates, like whatever. And sometimes it means that, you know, we're moving a big tent that's fractious and disagrees with each other, but that is actually the necessary work of democracy.
Hello, I'm Marcy Ryan, and I'm the print editor for Convergence. If you're enjoying this show like I am, I hope you'll consider subscribing to Convergence. We're a small, independent operation and rely heavily on our readers and listeners like you to support our work. You can become a subscriber at convergencemag.com/donate. You'll find a direct link in the show notes. Subscriptions start at just $10 a month, or you can make a one-time donation of any amount. At any donation level, know that you're helping to build a better media system, one that supports people's movements and fights fascism. But at $10 monthly and above, you'll have access to exclusive content and events. If you can't afford anything right now, don't worry. Our shows and print content will continue to be free for you to enjoy. You can also help by leaving us a positive review or sharing this episode with a comrade, a friend, or a family member. Thank you so much for listening.
So another issue, though, that we're facing is the loss of the power of majorities, right? Poll after poll and ballot measure after ballot measure, majorities are clearly saying that they want to protect abortion access. Mm-hmm. Public support is also high for gun safety reforms, for, living wages, for universal health care, so many things. Mm-hmm. And yet, we seem to be sliding to the right. So how do you explain this disconnect between the will of the people and this national slide to the right that we've been in for quite a while now?
I come to this work as an organizer. And so I think through that lens. We need to do a better job contesting. I'm coming to you right now from Amarillo, Texas, where, you know, I have people who are very active in beating back an abortion-related travel ban that they frame as abortion trafficking, right? So their concept is that anybody who is leaving the state of Texas to go get an abortion is trafficking a fetus in the same way that somebody else would be, you know, sex trafficking or what have you. And we won. And it, like in the one of the reddest towns in the reddest part of one of the reddest states. And all of this is to say that there are people here who agree with us. They are not engaged. They're not organized. We don't reach out to them, because when we get into big data organizing, you know, that kind of thing, we start making decisions based on ROI, cost effectiveness. You know, where do we have the reach? You know, we start doing math and thinking about, you know, whatever. And I understand we have a scarcity of resources. Sometimes you have to make tough decisions. But I think that, and I don't just say this because Women's March likes to scrap, because, you know, we do like to squabble. But we do have to contest more. So when we are in red places that we're just not going to win, it doesn't mean that we can't still fight. At the very least, we make them pay attention to places that they don't usually pay attention to, and we make things cost more so that they don't have unlimited resources, you know, to just pour into the fights that are closer. And for me, you know, it's like I'm from Milwaukee and from the city, you know, people there play a lot of basketball. And my analogy is always, I'm not going to let anybody dunk on me without putting a hand in their face. They may still dunk on me, but I'm going to play a little defense along the way. You know what I mean? And so I think that that's important. I want a hand in the face of those who would push an authoritarian agenda. And then the second piece is, that's us to them. But us to us is, we have got to rebuild our organizing muscle. And I think that along the way somewhere, we got very confused between building personal networks and political homes. And political, like personal networks are places, you know, I'm sure we've all been on coalition calls or something like that where people said, this is not a safe space. Like, you know, there's been hurt and harm. And that really, really matters when you're inside of your personal networks and someone is accountable to a relationship with you, to agreements that you've made as friends, as comrades, you know, whatever that looks like. But in a political home, you may well be working with somebody that you would, you know, not piss on if they were on fire in the street, if it meant that you have a shared goal and you are building power to a shared, you know, a shared tactical power or some sort of shared goal. And we have gotten away from that sort of clear-eyed, laser-focused organizing and power building. And as a result, I think that our coalitions have suffered and our people power has suffered because now we have a series of litmus tests for people to get involved and also have become actually quite hostile for new organizers. Women's March organizers, many of them are new. And what we hear all the time from our people saying, people in X, Y, or Z community say, well, where the fuck have you been? And, oh, you must be so privileged that you haven't been here this whole time. You know, how dare you come in now? And I think we really need to shift that mindset because I understand it. I understand the frustration. You know, I've never not worked in social justice. This has been my whole career. I studied it in school. I understand the impetus to say, you know, like, well, where are you now? But we really need to move beyond that personal, you know, reaction and move to a response of welcome. Here's the work. Because there's too much. We just do not have time for to let our emotional responses get in the way. And another way to say that would be we need systemic solutions to systemic oppression, and we cannot let interpersonal challenges get in the way of us building that systemic, you know, answer. Because if we do, we're going to lose democracy based on, you know, kind of like hurt feelings and, you know, whatever. And I'm not saying that how you move in movement doesn't matter. Like, we have to have integrity and we have to move forward. But there also just has to be space for organizing with people with whom you don't have disagreement or that you don't have alignment, excuse me. There, we have to have a clearer-eyed vision of building power and some sort of step. Ashley Henderson talks about strategy. And she's like, you know, strategy is like you're on the first floor. You need to get to the second floor. What are the steps that you're going to take to get there? And part of that has to be that we're organizing with people that we may not be friends with, you know, but we have to be committed to organizing and building people power anyway. There's just no other way around it.
Yeah, you know, Rachel, because I'm old, I've been doing this for a long time, since 1979. I remember a time in the 80s when I'd moved to Portland, Oregon, the whitest major city in the country, and joined political organizations and basically found out by joining that race was not even an issue for some of them, right? They were very uncomfortable with LGBTQ people. And so I would be told things like, race is not a democracy issue because the overwhelming majority are not concerned about it. And democracy is about majorities, right? Which is really not the theory of governance that we live under. And the other thing was to tell me, it's okay that you're gay because we can't tell. And then they would point out the other people who are gay in the room and say, you can't tell that they are gay either. We're talking about the ones that you can tell. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't be visible mm-hmm. in our work, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, I mean, those of us who were there didn't run away. We hung in and mm-hmm. we developed a kind of a discipline for how to deal with those situations because we were clear-eyed about the prize, mm-hmm. right? The prize was political influence and power. Mm-hmm. And these were the vehicles through which we could get that, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you hang in with people and you understand that they're complex, that they have many contradictory ideas, mm-hmm. And you develop the relationships of trust necessary to persuade them. Mm-hmm. And we did that over a really long period of time. And, you know, there are no more almost all white progressive organizations in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And that's due to many, many people who understood the importance of that kind of discipline in order to be able to build the kinds of coalitions necessary that can seize power. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm just so glad to hear organizations out there now who are moving that message, because we seem to have lost a thread on that mm-hmm. for a while, mm-hmm. right? So good time to pick it up again, because it seems to me as though the danger people are in is one that we haven't carefully gauged.
Yes.
You know, it may seem hard to get into those coalitions now because people will treat you in ways that make you feel unsafe. But you have to keep in mind that as conditions grow more repressive, we will be more and more likely to choose those coalitions because of the contrast that they will, you know, because of the contrast of them with the authoritarians who are taking over. But if we wait too long, we might not be too welcome when we get there mm-hmm. because they will feel far more vulnerable and not want to be associated with targets, right? Mm-hmm. So this is the time.
I think also we have to be clear on what is safe and what is comfortable. You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of wild to me. My undergraduate degree is in social movements. And a lot, probably half of what I studied is the civil rights movement, as is not very surprising to folks. And I think that it is a strange and modern concept to me that this work is safe. You know, in the same sense mm-hmm. that, like, if you are a person who works at an oil refinery, you accept that there is risk of that. My brother works at an oil refinery, and something just blew up there yesterday and someone got hurt. Or if you work in a factory, and you might get hurt, or if you're a window washer and you might fall, you take steps to make sure that that doesn't happen. There are safety procedures, et cetera, but it is not free of risk. This is not. So somewhere along the way, in addition to that, we've decided that, you know, this concept of safety up to and including people's hurt feelings, right? Which is really, you know, not safety, but comfort, in some spaces is actually a goal that has achieved primacy over the goal of impact. And I think that we have to be clear. We have to be clear about that to say mm-hmm. that the struggle, Barbara Smith, our Women's March senior advisor and OG, you know, author of the Combahee River Collective Statement and my mentor, every time I call her up and I'm telling her about something that went sideways, she sighs and she listens and she says, you know, I love you, but they call it the struggle because it's hard. So, you know, basically, like, deal with it, like, you know, and I'm going to listen to you and I care. Another mentor who's a little, you know, different, said, you know, she'll listen to me and she's, you know, and her feedback is, I love you and I'm listening to you and I'm going to listen to you as long as it takes, but no one gives a fuck about your feelings. And I think that we have to get very clear. I call my friends or people that I trust in my networks to talk about my hurt feelings or whatever, but there's no way that I can be in principled leadership or stewardship of an organization and put my hurt feelings or my pride or my ego or my visibility or my clout in front of the organization's ability to drive impact against our mission. And I think that we have to be much more disciplined and rigorous about that.
Organizing is not safe space, not even always internally, but especially it's often not safe space externally. Mm-hmm. And I think you're absolutely right. People have to kind of, you know, come to grips with that a little bit. I'm curious about your thoughts on the strategies and the narratives and messages that actually have worked to protect women's rights, particularly abortion rights. Mm-hmm. What have you seen out there that has kind of stuck with you? And we've had a couple of, I thought they were kind of unlikely victories in Kentucky and Kansas, but mm-hmm. I'm sure there are more. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's funny that I'm on y'all's Queer Ass podcast talking about this, because some of the same language that has worked on this for, you know, post-Dobbs is actually very similar to the same language that worked in the marriage equality fight. And that is to say that rights-based language generally doesn't fly. It is not the messages that are driving the victories, particularly in the places that you name, Kansas, Ohio, and red states. But what does fly is freedom. Freedom-based messages. Mm-hmm. So you'll see the repro movement calling it reproductive freedom. And of course, you know, if you were in the LGBT movement, you know, you were probably upbraided. Do not call it gay marriage. Don't call it, you know, whatever. Don't say that we have the right to marry everybody. Say you should be able to love, marry who you love. You should have the freedom to marry who you love. And so what I think ends up happening is that when we have conversations about like rights, that for some reason, how it lands to folks is that because, and particularly those people who are not under attack at any given point in time, there's the sense of we all have the same rights. And what you're talking about, when you're talking about if it's framed as gay marriage, or you're talking about the right to an abortion, it seems like you want some stuff that everyone has, and then you want some extra stuff on top of that. You want this gay marriage stuff, you want these extra rights to do this and that. And then that language seems to be, for some reason, vulnerable to perversion from the right, where they'll say, Donald Trump said this yesterday, some of these states have abortion up to birth and even after birth. You know, and so just bizarre, you know what I mean? Like, I mean, that was probably lie 2,589 last night. Like, but specifically the freedom narrative works much better than other messages. And I would say, you know, some of the opposite messages are the things that we see of like, that when women and gay people have these extra rights, they abuse them, you know, is the opposition messages that seem to land.
This podcast is presented by the 22nd Century Initiative, a hub for strategy and action for frontline activists, national leaders, and people like you.
At 22ci.org, you can sign up for our newsletter. You can learn from our anti-authoritarian playbook, which includes resources on how to block rising authoritarianism, bridge across the multiracial majority, and build an inclusive pro-democracy movement in your community.
So, Rachel, we previously had Maria Stephan of the Horizons Project on our podcast, and you know her.
Mm-hmm.
She helped us to understand the strength and successes of nonviolent social movements throughout history. And according to her research, as you know, these social movements were notably more successful with the leadership of women.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you see women's leadership as a key to, you know, really actualizing the democracy we want in this country?
I mean, the first thing I do is I just think historically, you know, what is, you know, when durable leadership has happened, and I mean really the exercise of leadership, not necessarily visible leadership, because we know, you know, in social movements, including the civil rights movement, that we don't always, the people who are forward facing in the telling or even in the media are not always the people who are actually leading, you know, in the sense that organizing people, building the power, etc. So I think that I always tell people, well, I've started telling people a new thing, but my example of this is always, it's actually a man, but I think that it relates to women in terms of being unseen. But, you know, I went to grad school in Boston, and I found out in Boston that Paul Revere, known for the Midnight Ride, you know, the British are coming. He was actually a very successful silversmith. So you can go to churches and, you know, historical buildings all around Boston and see his work. He was, you know, actually quite good. The bells, some bells that ring over Boston right now still are the bells that he crafted. But it was his volunteer work that wrote him into history. And you never know when you're going to pick up a volunteership, when you're going to stuff the envelope, that's the letter that puts somebody over the top, when you're going to have, you know, a sign that galvanizes the, you know, 10 more people to get engaged. And those are the 10 people that flip something. Here in Amarillo, we had a protest, and it was about the Mifepristone case where, you know, when Judge Kaczmarek was trying to, and I use the word judge there very loosely, was trying to outlaw medication abortion in the country. And six women met that day, and they formed an organization called the Amarillo Reproductive Freedom Alliance. And they are the local organization that defeated the travel ban here in Amarillo. So you never know when the thing that you do, when I was like, oh no, only 50 people are here, you know, like, ah, like I hate, you know, I hate this. I don't want to project, you know, weakness or whatever, but you really just never know when that spark is going to hit and really drive change. And I think that the Paul Revere thing is really important because so much of organizing work is unseen. And so much of women's work in general is unseen. And it's not just the work that we do in the houses or in communities or in families or et cetera. It's also the work that women are overrepresented in the workplace as well, whether we're talking about nurses or organizers or, you know, teachers or what have you. There's a problem with women's work being unseen, unacknowledged, under-resourced, undervalued. And so I think that women's leadership becomes key to actualizing democracy because we are seeing all of the folks who are doing the work that actually undergirds the action of democracy. We visibilize and give agency to the humans who are actually, you know, the cornerstones, the unit of change, you know, in any democracy is a person. And inside of many communities in our country, the people who are organizing communities, PTAs, you know, or like, you know, social change organizations, but also just playdates, you know, work potlucks, you know, what have you, are women. And so I think that whether we're talking about now, like a social media group, or whether we're talking about, you know, however many years ago, a quilting club, you know, women have been the cornerstone of how the connective tissue of our democracy works together. And when you put those folks who are doing that work into leadership roles, I think you necessarily have a more just society. I would love to give an example of the flip side of that. And that is in a 2016 election, obviously the first woman, you know, that was the first woman who's going to run for president, probably the most, you know, whether or not you agree with her politics, you know, probably one of the most qualified candidates that's ever run for president. Mm-hmm. And I just learned this the other week, and I'm going to spread the word on it. There was a group of hackers, basically, in Macedonia, who were selling supplements, memory supplements, bone supplements, joint supplements, and what they, in 2016. And what they found is that when they attached disinformation or attacks on Hillary Clinton, that these supplements sold better to a certain demographic of humans, older men suffering from memory problems, joint problems, et cetera. And so they made a number of websites. And they ran the supplement ads as banner ads on the websites. And that group of Macedonians who became very wealthy behind this business scheme also were responsible for 50% of the disinformation and misinformation on Hillary Clinton. Came from this troll farm in Macedonia and is widely considered to have tanked that election for her. So we have to understand both the ways in which that situation, basically American democracy caught astray in 2016 behind memory supplements that who knows if they're even real. But the second piece is how effective it is to weaponize attacks about women and the broad reaching impacts, you know, of those attacks when they occur. And I think it's particularly because, you know, sexism is a bipartisan value, unfortunately, and because when the fabric of society is torn apart, it actually becomes so much harder to mount a good, you know, resistance. And not to say that it wasn't enough. Obviously, we got Donald Trump out once, but here he comes again, you know, and what could the movement have looked like if we actually were able to unite past the, like, Bernie, Hillary's, you know, camps and past the like division inside of the movement that was really quite polarized at the very beginning based on whether or not how you felt about Hillary Clinton as a candidate. So, you know, she's a complicated person with politics there, but, you know, one has to wonder whether a male candidate would have been vulnerable to the same kind of attacks.
It seems to me really important for people to remember that we have political authoritarianism that's threatening us, but that political authoritarianism and cultural authoritarianism go together. And that one of the ways that cultural authoritarianism is normalized for most people is in gender relations. So good to know, right? Sue, you have a question.
Yeah. Well, as our friend Urvashi Vaid once said, there are things to do. And Rachel, we know you have some things to do today. So as a wrap-up, I'm hoping you might share with us a Rachelism or two, something that you always tell folks to perk them up, to keep them in the campaign, to keep them going.
I already gave you my Paul Revere. That's my go-to. But I would say that the other thing that I would say is, you know, I have a nervous stomach, you know, so before all of our marches, I'm always like somewhere from a high perch, I'm in a building somewhere nearby, and I'm counting the crowd. and what one of the movement scholars, L.A. Kaufman, told me once is that it was just like a group of 10 people coming out every day for like months that got Nixon impeached. You know, they would just go sit on the ellipse with their little 10 people and their signs. And, you know, I know that the times are different. Social media makes the urgency, you know, not the urgency, but I think it has changed our relationship to scale. Let's put it that way. And I actually reject some of the ideas that people say that scale no longer matters. I reject that out of hand. But I think that that it's important to note that, like, this week we had, you know, the anniversary of the Dobbs decision was on Monday. And we had actions across the country. And there was one in Mississippi that had two people. And they were, you know, on our GBrief call, and they said, oh, I'm so upset, you know, what have you. And what I had to tell them is that it takes so much more political courage for two people to hold up signs on the side of the road in Mississippi than it does for 10,000 people to get together in Washington, D.C. or Brooklyn, New York, you know, or what have you. And that we have to understand that scale is not impact, and that we can only understand what impact is when we understand what our goals are. And so when we're talking about the election here, of course, I recognize I'm not, you know, naive. Of course, I recognize we're in an election year, and I recognize the stakes of that election. But I also recognize that the rise of authoritarianism and that the political balance will not be shifted, you know, in this election or even the next election. And we've been telling folks for a really long time, this is the most important election of your life. And it's actually been true. And it's true because, you know, of our continued slide. And so what I would say is we are not in a sprint. We are in a marathon. We are the people who are holding the baton for this leg of the race right now. And what our role is to run this leg as best we can and to be in the business of developing, you know, the people to hand this baton off to, because we are in a 25-year fight at minimum. And we need to have the kind of resiliency and clarity of vision, you know, alignment around goals and the creativity and diversity around tactics that get us to that point where we can win for all of us. And, you know, and in that work, it's head down, eyes forward, and don't be distracted by the nonsense. You know, that's all I can tell people. That's all I tell myself.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm going to lace up my sneakers and get moving.
Perfect.
Thank you, Rachel.
Hey, thanks again for listening. Find more episodes of the Anti-Authoritarian Podcast on all of your favorite platforms and also at 22ci.org and convergencemag.org. Direct links to these and other resources referenced in this episode are in the show notes.
The Anti-Authoritarian Podcast is created by the 22nd Century Initiative and published by Convergence Magazine. Our theme music is After the Revolution by Carsey Blanton and is licensed under Creative Commons. The show is hosted by Scott Nakagawa and Sue Hyde. Executive producers are James Mum and Tony Esbridge. Our producer is Josh Elstro, and Yong Chan Miller is our production assistant.